Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I'm glad to have you along this morning as well. According to a recent Gallup poll, 63% of Americans now believe it was a mistake to go to war in Iraq. That's an all-time high. And while John McCain is enjoying an easy ride for the time being, while Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton try to knock each other out of the ring, his position on Iraq is at odds with not only his fellow Vietnam vets in the Senate, but a considerable portion of the American people as well. This hour, we're talking with Matt Bai about his article, The McCain Doctrines, which runs in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. The article considers McCain's current position in Iraq and the influence his experience in Vietnam may have had. There's an open door for you this morning to share your thoughts. Did John McCain learn the right lessons from Vietnam, or is he reliving that war all over again, hoping for the ending he never got, this time with Iraq? The number to call this morning is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Matt Bai, so glad you could be with us this morning.
Hi, Veronica. How you doing?
Doing good. How about you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Well, your article opens by talking about the small group of Vietnam vets in the Senate, and we're talking here about Democrats John Kerry, Jim Webb, Republican Chuck Hagel. And of this group, you say that McCain is the only one who's really continued to kind of stand by his man, that is the war in Iraq. And you build the case here that it might be that the Vietnam John McCain experience was really different than what his cohorts in the Senate who were vets experienced. Can you tell us what that difference is?
Sure, and I would expand that group to include some of the senators who recently have served and don't anymore with Senator McCain, people like Bob Kerry, Chuck Robb, Max Cleland. Really, if you take a wide swath of Vietnam veterans who served in the Senate and in fact, in the House, combat veterans, you will find McCain is a real outlier on the war in Iraq. And it's not actually my theory, but there's a feeling among those who've served with him that much as they admire McCain's record of service and his incredible endurance during his time as a prisoner of war, and they do admire it greatly, as do I, there's a feeling that his experience in Vietnam was different for not having gone through the disillusionment and the moral confusion that came with being on the ground in the jungle, in the rice paddies, not being able to tell your enemy from your friend, not trusting your superiors, feeling as if you were being sent into harm's way for a mission that was neither clear nor achievable. And those veterans came back, guys like Hagel and John Kerry and Bob Kerry and Jim Webb, came back from Vietnam feeling as though that there had been miscalculations from their own superiors and that, in fact, some wars simply could not be won. And of course, this is a lesson you could apply to a lot of interventions by powers in internal conflicts throughout history, even the American Revolution, where, you know, insurgent forces just tend to have greater will and greater knowledge of the landscape. McCain, of course, was sealed away from that situation. He was, by no desire of his own, he was tortured in a prison camp for 5.5 years. And when he emerges, he goes home, he goes to the National War College, and he studies, and he comes away with kind of a different lesson of what happened, having not gone through any of that experience, and that is that a winnable war was effectively abandoned because the public lost heart in part because the strategy pursued there was disastrous for the first half of the war. Now, you know, you can argue that McCain had a better, more objective view of it because he didn't go through that experience on the ground, or you can argue, as some other veterans would, that I think that McCain simply didn't see the war up close and therefore didn't have the same integral understanding of what went wrong. But I think to understand those differences and how they've evolved over the last 30 years is to understand the different perspectives that are informing the debate over Iraq.
Well, this is obviously really touchy territory because you sort of get into trying to, you know, understand McCain from a psychological perspective, understand what's going on in his head, and at the same time, you don't want to slight what he went through in a prison camp. He was tortured. On the other hand, it does sound like he sort of missed out on what made the 60s the 60s, and a big part of that was this sort of sense of betrayal by Washington.
Yes, I think it's fair to say both because he was the son and grandson of celebrated admirals, and because of his experience in Vietnam, I think it would be fair to say that he did miss out on that feeling of betrayal and resentment. It's not clear how he would have responded, obviously, had he been flying missions. I mean, a lot of veterans will tell you that it was different for the flyers, the bombers anyway, because they didn't see the destruction on the ground. They saw a different war, too. Everybody and people in the United States saw a different war. Everyone had a different perspective. I think the point is that while all those perspectives can be, or most of them can be respected in some way, they also inform who you become. I mean, look, Veronica, you're exactly right. You put it very well. It's a touchy subject. It verges on insult to some people, and it also verges on psychologizing, as Gary Hart calls it in the piece. But we can't not talk about things because they might insult people. You have to do it respectfully and at length, and with sensitivity, which is, you know, what we're able to do in the magazine because we have a lot of space to discuss these things in context. It's not shorthanded. And ultimately, what I believe in my philosophy as a journalist is that if you really want to understand how people will react to situations and what convictions they carry into their responsibilities governing, and you need to understand where their views were forged and who they see when they look in the mirror, because the self-image and the long-held convictions and attitudes of people are what inform the decisions they make. And so I think if you want to understand what kind of president John McCain is going to be and why he approaches Iraq the way he does, you must understand Vietnam. You must understand where he comes from as best you can. You never get it exactly right. You can't get in somebody's head, and you have to have the humility to know that, but I think you have to make the effort.
Well, just to get a little deeper into what he sees maybe as the similarities or what we can, the parallels that we can draw now, in Vietnam, when the war was over, we were starting to pursue what I think John McCain would consider a pretty good path there. We were trying to win the hearts and minds of the South Vietnamese and also trying to hand over the reins of power to them so that they took responsibility a bit, and which is, you know, that's pretty parallel to what is being done in Iraq right now, plus the surge. Mm-hmm. And is it your sense that he thinks that now we finally kind of hit on the right tactic?
Yes, that is my sense. I mean, there are, I wouldn't want to make too facile comparisons between Iraq and Vietnam because there are some significant differences, beginning, you know, at the top of the list with the level of casualties we're talking about and the fact that there's no draft today as there was in the, it's not the exact same nature mm-hmm. of war. But there are echoes of one conflict in the other that as Iraq becomes more protracted in engagement, I think are very hard to ignore. And, as you point out, one of those echoes is about a failed strategy, a change in strategy halfway through, Vietnamization of the armed forces and the government, which is really becoming a kind of Iraqization plan, although they're not calling it that. You did have, you know, lawmakers in Vietnam arguing that even no matter how poorly the war went, if America left, the dominoes would fall and this evil, godless ideology of communism would spread across the region, which is not all that dissimilar from the warnings that if you were to lose in Iraq, terrorism would spread throughout the region, a similar ideology. So there are echoes, and I think McCain sees this very acutely because it was his contention, learning what he learned after the Vietnam War, that up until 1968, the United States had pursued a flawed and disastrous policy and a strategy in Vietnam, and that the real shift from conventional warfare to counterinsurgency happened after 1968, that it was very successful. And that it was ultimately doomed because they continued to draw down troops because the American public had effectively given up on the war. This is not an anomalous view by any means. Excuse me. It's been held by many people in the military for years. There's a lot of military historians who have always seen the conflict this way from their perspective. And if you see it that way, then there are parallels with Iraq because the surge that McCain championed and that General Petraeus has implemented in Iraq would seem to be a similar move toward counterinsurgency after a similarly flawed approach to the war, and it has definitely lowered casualties. It has definitely led to more stability and more safety for American troops. The question, of course, is where you go then and how that leads to political settlement and how those troops can ever leave and whether you can get Iraq to the point where it can provide its own security and have its own governmental stability. But all those things aside, if you believed that was possible in Vietnam, then it follows you would believe it is possible here.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you actually interviewed John McCain personally about his policy on foreign policy, and you didn't get the sense necessarily that he was going to be just locked into this course on Iraq. I think at one point he even said, well, no, if there was a huge groundswell of public opinion against Iraq, we'd have to leave.
Yeah.
So he sounded as though he was pretty reasonable about it, even given his support of the war.
Well, this too is the lesson he draws from Vietnam. I mean, McCain doesn't say we lost Vietnam because, you know, the public was just silly and wanted to give up on the war and didn't care about American interests. That's not his point at all. His point is that through poor military leadership in the first part of the war and through poor political leadership and communication, the public became disillusioned and had every right to be disillusioned. And when the public is disillusioned and loses faith in a war, you can't continue to fight it. And in fact, this has been his animating philosophy throughout his career. As you look back, as I did, at his entire career, and first in the House and then in the Senate, he was very clear about not undertaking interventions where he felt the public simply would not support extended interventions or escalations, where he felt that there was shaky ground for the public. And so what McCain is saying is, look, if this surge works, I think the public's going to come around. I think they're going to agree with me. I think they're going to be willing to tolerate longer years of war. We're going to get this right. But if casualties go up and the strategy doesn't work, the public's already, you know, on the verge of disillusionment. And if that happens, if the public loses faith, as it did in Vietnam, there's just nothing I or anyone else can do. They're not going to tolerate a longer war. Now, you know, as I point out in the piece, the problem with this argument, which sounds pretty rational, is that there's been, to this point, no correlation between casualties or success in Iraq and public opinion. In other words, people think the surge, if you look at the Gallup polling on this, which I think is pretty good, people consider the surge over the last year to have been very successful, but it hasn't changed their view about wanting to get out of Iraq. And in fact, it's made them more inclined over that time period. They've become more inclined to think that the war was a mistake. So McCain is making a connection that I'm not sure is valid, which is he's saying, look, if we get this right, people are going to change their minds about the war. He's assuming they haven't already cemented their opinions. And in that sense, I'm not sure he's right.
Well, it's interesting, too, though, because I think maybe if you'd been talking about this a year ago, it would have been very hot. You know, Iraq would have been the number one thing on people's minds. But going into this election year, the economy has bumped Iraq in terms of what people are most concerned about. I don't know if getting a free pass is the right phrase, but do you think maybe this is not going to be looked at quite as closely because of the economy?
Well, I'd look at it a little differently. I mean, we sometimes rank issues in an election in the same way that people, you know, rank graduate schools or law schools, you know, graduate schools or colleges, when in effect, you know, or say college football teams, when in effect there is no perfect ranking, right? You know, the top five might all be just about in the same place, and it's all subjective. It is true the economy has become a huge issue in the headlines. I think this is going to go back and forth. I think both issues are going to matter. I mean, McCain is banking a lot of his campaign on national security, and I think national security will be one of the large issues. I'm sorry, that was my phone beeping, so just ignore it. But let's give McCain a little bit of credit here, I think, where it's deserved, which is that part of the reason Iraq has faded from the immediate headlines is not just because the economy has worsened, but also because casualties have declined and headlines have gone away. And whereas a year ago we were getting, you know, every day headlines of more soldiers lost, more disaster in the making, we've seen relatively little of that lately. People are less reminded of it, and I think that has to be in some measure a result of the strategy of sending these additional 20,000 troops over there and pursuing a different strategy of counterinsurgency, and that's something McCain agitated for years against the administration when Donald Rumsfeld didn't want to do it and the president didn't want to do it. So I think you have to give McCain some credit for being in that situation. If he gets, as you put it, a pass, it's going to be partly because the strategy he championed has tamped down interest in Iraq and made it less of an urgent issue for a lot of people who oppose the war.
Well, you're a reporter. What's the sense you get from?
I hope so.
What's the sense you get about whether or not that's true? Are people going to be turning to McCain's side here and saying, "Yeah, I guess he's right. I guess it is working"?
Boy, I don't know. I that's not reporting. That's prognostication. I think the polling tells you no. The polling tells you that people are, as I said, that people do not equate the success, whatever measured success the surge has had, with a change in attitude about the war. That is, people who don't like this war don't like this war. They're a majority of the American public. There is not yet any evidence to suggest that they're going to change their minds because the strategy works. will they be more inclined to tolerate a different opinion on the war if they like other things about a candidate? Yes. I think that's probably a good gamble, right? If you're John McCain right now and your thinking is, you may not agree with me on the war, but when people were dying every day in the headlines for a war I had championed, I had no chance. And now, you know, you might look at me and say, well, you know, you were kind of right about the strategy. The casualties are down. I don't think we should be there. I'm never going to agree with you on this, but I'm willing to judge you on a host of other issues. I think that's probably attainable for him.
Talking this hour with Matt Bai, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. His article, The McCain Doctrine, is the cover story for the May 18th issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Well, what do you think? Do you think that John McCain has learned the right lessons from Vietnam? Do you think staying by Iraq, especially with the new policy, is going to help him in the November election? Or are you hoping for a different stance there? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 12:30 today, join us for Chapter a Day. Carl Schmidt reads from The Poet of Tolstoy Park, a novel by Sonny Brewer. A 67-year-old man, given a year to live by his doctors, decides instead to read Tolstoy and perfect his soul. That's coming up at 12:30 today on Chapter a Day. We're joined this hour by Matt Bai, a contributing writer for The New York Times. His article, The McCain Doctrines, is the cover story for the May 18th issue of The New York Times Magazine. And we're taking a look this hour at the effect Vietnam may have had on John McCain, whether he drew different lessons than a lot of his colleagues who were Vietnam vets, and what those lessons mean to his policy in Iraq. And Matt Bai, we're going to go ahead and take some phone calls now and
Please. Talk
to Al in La Crosse. Hi, yes. Al, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, people make choices, and John McCain made a choice to bomb civilian targets in the north, and he was shot down. And unfortunately for him, he was a POW for several years after that. But that does not excuse the fact that he was bombing civilian targets in the north in a war that was wrong from the beginning. My own choice was to join the Marines in 65. And by the time 68 came along, I realized it was the wrong thing to do. It was killing people unnecessarily. It made no sense whatsoever, and I wound up in federal prison as a war resister. So people do have those choices to make. The second point is that in terms of warfare, tactics does not trump strategy or the original position of the war. If the war is wrong, it's like if you saw your neighbor beating another neighbor with a stick. The argument is not going to be about how big a stick or how long a stick or how long you should use the stick or, you know, who saw you using the stick or whether you should have kept on using it longer or whatever. The argument is going to be take the stick away and you're going to go to jail. You know, I mean, or the person using the stick is going to go to jail. I mean, this idea that we can win on something by using different tactics when the premise of the entire conflict is wrong, both in Vietnam and in Iraq, and I would also go on to say Nicaragua and other countries as well, is just a failed idea, and it fails to get to the root of the problem, which is somehow trying to justify an action which wasn't justifiable from the very get-go. That's my comment.
All right. Thanks a lot, Al. Matt, bye.
Well, Al, I appreciate your comments, and I respect what you did as a war resister, and I think John McCain would say he respects it as well. I've heard him talk about his respect for people who made choices on conscience. You know, I was born in 1968, and to whatever extent that's relevant, I'm not going to pass judgment on what John McCain or anybody else did, or John Kerry or anyone else did during their service in Vietnam and what they were asked to do by their government. I think it was a time of difficult choices and confusing situations, and I think people were loyal in the best way they knew how, yourself included and John McCain included. I think he would argue that the question is actually not what you think is, and I think this is an interesting debate, and in part it has a real impact on the politics of this issue, which is, you know, where is the fight? Is the fight over whether you should have gone to war in Iraq? That's a fight John McCain's going to lose. I don't think there's any question in the polling, and I don't think he would argue with that. That's a fight he loses. He felt there were weapons of mass destruction, as a lot of people did. He felt that justified the invasion. He still does. He told me clearly that was the reason to go into Iraq, and obviously it wasn't the case. But I think he would argue, and a lot of people in the foreign policy establishment would argue, that actually ceases to be the question. When you're in a country, when it's destabilized, when it lacks for leadership, when it lacks for security, when you've made the mess, and when your security in the region and globally is at issue, then you do have not just a responsibility, but certainly a national interest in figuring out how to stabilize the situation. And I think then the question becomes, you know, how is it stabilized? Is it best stabilized by withdrawing, by just getting out? Are you making it worse every day that you're there, exacerbating wounds, or can it be stabilized on the ground? Those are difficult policy questions that we absolutely have to and should debate going toward November. But I think to sort of turn you back and say the only question here is whether we should have gone into Iraq or not, and what happens now. You can't possibly make the situation better because it was bad from the start. That from a policy standpoint doesn't strike me as making a lot of sense, but it may very well be an important political question.
Thanks for that call, and we'll take one now from Charlie in Hudson. Hi, Charlie, you're up.
Oh, hi. I was in Vietnam through 65 to 68, hanging off the coast, picking up pilots that got shot down. And McCain's statement a while back about, you know, bomb, 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 Iran, was the sort of thing they were singing back then, except it was bomb, 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 Hanoi. And unfortunately, he wasn't smart enough to get his plane off into the water, the Gulf of Tonkin, so he could have picked him up. And so he had to spend some time in prison. I more or less look at him as a bad pilot rather than a hero. But don't understand. I wouldn't trust this guy any more than I trust George Bush. And that's it. I just had to get that statement in because these guys used to act like real hot dogs after they got through dropping their bomb. I was up by Hanoi and Haiphong Harbor. And these guys would, after they dropped their load on who knows what, would do all these aerial acrobats in the air as they came by us at full speed, you know, and like an air show, you know, like real hot doggers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I look at him. I understand he had the nickname Punk when he was in high school or college or whatever. That's kind of the way I look at him. Wouldn't trust the man as president.
Thanks. All right. Thank you for the call, Stephen. And Stephen, obviously someone who had a very different perception of what the war in Vietnam meant.
Yeah, I think it was Charlie, wasn't it? Maybe I've got that wrong.
Yeah, you're right. It was Charlie.
Okay,
my apologies. Charlie,
I want to say I think it's important to say that I respect your service and I thank you for it. And it's something I greatly admire. Not having done it, I have no idea whether Senator McCain was doing 360s or whatever he was doing when he was bombing in Hanoi and I think he would be the first one to tell you, and has written in his books, that he was less responsible, less directed in his youth before Vietnam, and that experience changed him in some ways. But I think where I would take issue, if I might, would just be I don't think I'm going to sit here and even as a reporter and just let pass the notion that there's nothing heroic about John McCain's service. I think those 5.5 years in a prison camp, I think the way he conducted himself, the fact that he refused to leave before others when he was offered the opportunity, the fact that he was tortured and suffered physical disabilities for his life, the fact that his fellow prisoners considered him a real rock and a hero with them. I think all the guys who went through that deserve a sort of enduring respect. I think it is a form of heroism to withstand that for your country, and I think we can have the debate about politics and even the debate about his service without belittling that accomplishment and that contribution.
Well, you definitely get the sense reading your article, whether it comes from his experience in Vietnam, which I assume it does, but that he's genuinely really grappling with what these things mean. And it's not been an easy road to take all by himself in some cases, especially as the tides of public opinion sort of ebb and flow, and he's sitting there and he's trying to sort of stay true to his conscience, what he really believes.
You know, Veronica, it's a good point. One of the things that's troubling to me about this political era in general is that it's so hyper-partisan and we're so distrustful of one another that we tend not to credit politicians in general for this. We tend to see cynically everything as a political calculation, we tend to assume that everybody is just given this clarity of vision, whether they're right or wrong. I think most politicians, most public servants grapple with these issues. I think they understand or try to understand the complexities. The people who frighten me in politics are the people who don't seem to want to grapple with the complexities, are the people who seem to be certain of themselves all the time. That's not John McCain, certainly. I mean, I've covered McCain on and off for many years, you know, long periods not, and then some periods where I have. And he, you know, he's not a person of unflinching self-certainty. He, if you read any of his books, in fact, he has a almost worrisome penchant for apologizing for things he does constantly. He's the most apologizing politician I've ever met in terms of reevaluating the decisions he makes. And I do think he has grappled with this. I think there are things he would do differently. I don't think this is easy for him. I don't for a minute believe that he thinks people who oppose him are fools. But I do think he has an unwavering conviction that it is important to stay in Iraq until the mission is accomplished. And I think this question of whether that mission can be accomplished is going to be a critical question for this campaign. It ought to be, because he's certain that it can be, and most people are not.
Well, it's interesting because if you've read much about Barack Obama, I think it might have been in his Audacity of Hope. I'm actually getting the information from an interview that we did with him here. Barack Obama talks about the election in terms of being ready to reframe sort of the 60s, whether you're ready to move past the arguments of the 60s that sort of defines an old political framework, or to move on. And I wonder how that would play out in terms of John McCain and his experience in Vietnam.
Well, this is, again, I mean, Veronica, you've got lots of good questions. This is a question we could spend a whole show on, because, you know, what's interesting is I've heard Obama make that argument before he was a presidential candidate. I heard him talk at length about moving beyond that period of time, and I find it to be the most compelling thing he talks about, perhaps because of my generational identity, and because of what I've seen in Washington as a reporter. He really, you know, I'm glad he said that to you. He really tamped that down during the primary campaign, and I think because, let's face it, a lot of reliable Democratic primary voters see the 60s as their primary period of identity, and they don't want to move beyond it, and they certainly don't want to be told that it doesn't matter anymore, and they continue to view the world through that prism. And so I think this is one of the great questions over the general election campaign, and I do not know the answer, but I'm very, very curious, is whether Barack Obama, having secured the nomination of his party, when and if he does, will go out to the country and again make this case about the end of the 60s and moving on and getting beyond sort of the baby boomer mindset of politics, which will irritate some of the more orthodox thinkers in his own party. People who have clung to ideologies for a very long time, and in doing so challenge really John McCain as a guy who's out of his moment, as a guy whose great heroics, however respectable, however great, are from a different Cold War era, or will he, you know, be more careful not to insult his own partisans, and in doing so sort of let McCain skate on that point, not make it about a generational clash. Because I think that generational issue is critical to Obama's appeal with a lot of people, but it doesn't sit well with some of the partisans in his own party who consider the orthodoxies, the policy orthodoxies of the late 20th century, to be integral to the Democratic Party.
Let's go back to the phones now and get a call from Carl in Shorewood. Hi, Carl, you're on the air.
Good morning, Veronica.
Good morning.
I'm of an opinion that John McCain has made a bad choice in terms of assuming that when the when and if the conflict is resolved, that there is a capable government willing to step forward and take control. I think that the military and al-Maliki and his parliament have shown over and over that they are incapable through corruption and ethnic conflict of establishing a government that can be stable and create a country where stability will exist.
Mm-hmm. Matt Bai?
Yeah, I think Carl raises a great point. I mean, I think this is a central question. I'll tell you that I was in Iraq prior to the war. I was in Saddam Hussein's Iraq for quite a period of time. have not been there since the war. So I only, like you, I go on what I read and the people I talk to, and I talk to a lot of military leaders who've been there during the course of this piece, reporting this piece. And I think this is, you know, this is kind of the crux of the issue, is when we talk about whether wars like this are winnable, the question is, can you create stability? Can you have a functioning, build a functioning government, a functioning military and police force? Can you keep them from killing each other? This is, you know, Iraq now is closer to a multi-ethnic civil war of the kind we saw in the Balkans than it is to a traditional Maoist conflict, people's conflict like you saw in Vietnam. And so, you know, the question is, can you ever take a conflict like this and by force of military means create a societal structure? And I would argue, and I think, you know, you would have historians who know better than I do and might well correct me. This is not my area of expertise. But from the knowledge I do have, I would argue that there are very few, if any, instances in history of achieving that aim. And I think Vietnam showed, in a sense, how difficult it is. I think virtually every imperial occupation in history has shown how difficult that is. You either rule by the force of your own will and military steel, right? You either have a lot of people and a lot of power and you use it pretty ruthlessly, or disorder ensues. I don't know of many examples where you sort of, you know, I guess the analogy would be, imagine trying to, you know, constantly shore up a sandcastle that you're holding together with your hands. I don't know of many examples where people have taken their hands away finally and the thing stands up and, you know, and withstands a wave. You know, I think it doesn't tend to work that way. And what we've not heard from John McCain or others is a convincing case of why this instance is different, why in this instance something can be achieved that most people do not consider to be possible.
We're talking this hour with Matt Bai, who is a contributing writer for The New York Times. His article, The McCain Doctrines, is the cover story for the May 18th issue of The New York Times magazine. We're wondering this hour what you think, whether John McCain has learned the right lessons from Vietnam and what you consider to be the right and wrong attributes of what he thinks about Iraq right now, the policy that he is supporting, which is to continue to stay in Iraq and try to stabilize the region. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We'd be happy to take your comments and questions by email as well. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. From 1 until 3, we'll be listening to that program live from Milwaukee. And in this hour, the Great Lakes Water Compact, a look at the plan from the perspective of one member state, Wisconsin, from pollution to invasive species, a report on the health of the Great Lakes. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're joined this hour by Matt Bai, a contributing writer for The New York Times, also author of The McCain Doctrines. That's the article which will be the cover story for the May 18th issue of the magazine. And Matt Bai, we've got some folks waiting to talk to you, so let's go ahead and take a call from Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff, you're on the air.
Very quick question. First of all, Matt Bai, I always enjoy your writing. Second of all, I think you said, or you quoted John McCain as saying, we are there until the mission is completed. I'd just like someone to define for me what the mission is this month, and I'll take my call offline. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I would too, Jeff. Thank you, and thank you for reading. I appreciate your comment very much. Yeah, it's a great question. I ask McCain again. That's me beeping in, and I apologize. I ask McCain this question, you know, what is victory in Iraq? And his answer was that at some point, you know, when our soldiers stop dying, when we have no casualties, and when you have a stable government and a stable military and police force in Iraq. Now, you know, the point I make in the piece, and it's rather uncharitable perhaps, and I'm sure Senator McCain would greatly take issue with it, but the point I've made is the overarching point of a war, that is your ultimate mission, can't be to have soldiers stop dying. Because if that's your overarching mission, that can be achieved rather easily, can't it? I mean, you just take them away. You know, the fact that, and I don't think, and I don't want to be too uncharitable, because I don't think that's what he actually means. I think pushed on it, you know, McCain will tell you that he thinks it's critical not to let the terrorists win, that it's critical not to let Iraq become a terrorist haven, that you have to, you know, that the stability of Iraq is critical to the stability of the region, to American interests. All of that is fine, but that's not the case he's making when asked about it. And I think it's going to be imperative for him as a candidate to put this in terms that people can relate to. That is, what when you say we've won, what is it going to look like? What's Iraq going to look like? And what's it going to look like for us, and why was it worth it? How is America's safety then improved? What does Iraq look like? What does the Middle East look like? Because if the mission is to stop soldiers from dying, then we can pretty much achieve that mission immediately, and in a way that is not acceptable to John McCain or a lot of other people. And so I think the way he talks about this is going to be very important.
Thanks a lot for that call. And we take one now from Fred in Beaver Dam. Welcome, Fred.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. I did kind of a double take. If I read this right yesterday, the article said that when McCain opted to go to the War College, he was a captain, and you implied that that was a kind of a junior rank to go to the War College. A naval captain's a pretty big guy. In the photo, he was a lieutenant commander when he was walking up the steps on the crutches.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question, Fred. I know he retired as a captain. Whether he was a captain at that moment, I thought he was promoted upon his return, but it's possible that I made a mistake there. I have to go back and look. I know that McCain, in his memoir on this, in his second memoir, he makes a point of saying that his commanders within the Navy balked at his request to go to the National War College, even though the returning prisoners of war had pretty much been given their choice of assignments, because he was junior and it was normally reserved for more senior officers. Now, if he was not a captain at that time, no one has said that to me, but it's possible that the timeline has been, let's not use the passive tense. It's possible that I've misconstrued the timeline because I make mistakes too, but I don't think so, and it certainly didn't come up in the fact-checking process at the magazine.
Well, just to change the topic from that a bit, there is a soundbite that's been circulating from one of McCain's talks where he mentions the possibility of staying in Iraq for 100 years, and that's sort of been pounced on by the Democrats. Can you put that remark into context for us?
You're talking about yesterday. Oh, the 100 years.
The 100 years that we might be there, yeah.
Yeah, John McCain has made this statement a bunch of times. It was, but I think it was during an event in Derry, New Hampshire, just before the primary, that he was sort of recorded and sort of nailed on it. And what he said was, they said, "How long would you like to be in Iraq?" And he said, "I don't care if we're there for a year, 5 years. I don't care if we're there for 100 years. We've been in Korea for decades and no one complains. We've been in Europe for decades and no one complains. If we're not losing any soldiers, if we're there to sort of keep peace and to serve a strategic interest, I don't think anyone's going to mind that, but we have to stay there and stabilize the situation." I'm paraphrasing, but that was essentially his answer. And a lot of Democrats jumped on this, and actually there's a rather, I think, insidious political ad. I'm used to the hardball of politics, but there's an ad I think is really sort of beyond the pale that the Democratic National Committee has been running, which just continually shows McCain saying, "I don't care if we're there for 100 years. I don't care if we're there for 100 years. And, you know, with no context whatsoever. And they keep saying McCain wants a 100-year war. McCain wants a 100-year war. McCain never said he would tolerate a 100-year war. In fact, what he told me specifically was that the public wouldn't tolerate that kind of protracted engagement. What McCain is effectively saying is that how long you stay there isn't the issue. It's whether or not you're losing soldiers. And that if we never lost another soldier in Iraq, no one would care how long a certain number of troops stayed behind to serve our strategic interests or to help the people there. And I think that's a fairly innocuous and, in terms of history, not challengeable statement. It is true that we've done that all over the world. And so I think he's just been sort of wildly taken out of context on that point. But it does show you how vulnerable he is on this point, because he is so unwavering in his support of the war, and because he does not seem to have bowed to what a lot of people consider reality. And it does show you how his opponents will try very hard, and perhaps with some success in this election, to make him seem like a reckless leader.
Yeah, one thing I'm curious about, you spent time with him, and as we've been talking here, you at one point said that you didn't think he was the sort of person who would doggedly stick with something that he thought wasn't working. I'm putting words into your mouth, but... And I'm wondering about a different article that I read in the New York Times, and this is one that came up much earlier and questioned his associations and whether some of them might be unethical. And in that article, I distinctly got the impression that he was the kind of guy who was a rogue member of the Republican Party for a reason, that he might be willing to hang on to things just for the sake of, you know, being a true believer, that he had that quality in his personality. I don't get that sense from you. Can you kind of explain the difference, what you
think? Well, there is a difference. I don't think I quite said what you're saying. I understand your point. I'm not saying that McCain won't hold on to an unpopular view long after it's untenable. He clearly will. And he has said, in fact, and he said at the end of my piece, I'd rather lose a campaign than lose a war. I mean, he's not changing his opinion on this. They may try to package it differently. But he is a stubborn guy, and he will stick to what he thinks is right. I think my point is more that I couldn't stick with my support of the war if the public completely abandoned it. I mean, mm-hmm. He's basically saying you can't continue to fight a war if the public gives up on it entirely. That's a slightly different thing. He's not saying that he's ever going. I don't think he's ever going to decide that this is not a war worth fighting. But he is, someone who would bow to the reality, you know, if he feels that there's simply not enough public support to continue on for a protracted engagement. So, you know, I do think he wrestles with these issues. I do think he's a pretty complex thinker. I certainly don't think he's unstable or so dug in that he doesn't acknowledge reality. But he absolutely can be a rogue thinker and a stubborn thinker, and he does not mind being in a small minority for a long period of time. And you saw that in, you know, campaign finance reform and a variety of other issues with which he's been associated in his career.
Well, I guess that's one of the things people are thinking about if he's president. Is he going to be so stubborn that he won't listen to the people around him? Is he so used to being the rogue thinker that he's gotten pretty comfortable there? Or is he going to accept, you know, criticism and checks?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think that's partly why his comment to me was important about public support. I mean, he recognizes that you can't just do whatever you want for a long period of time. He certainly can get dug in on things, but it's also worth noting, I think, that unlike, say, President Bush, McCain has always and continues to surround himself with a wider variety of opinion. This is why it's been very hard for people to pin him down, and some people say he's a neocon, and then other people say he's what you'd call a realist in the Scowcroft model, and because he listens to a wide variety of people, and even among his core supporters, there are different schools of thought represented there. So, it may well be that McCain is stubborn enough in some cases to disregard his own advisors. It's also true that he hears a wider variety of viewpoints, I think, than the current president does. So, and in fact, greatly admire the president's father for this reason as well. So I think that's, one of the things you don't know about someone until they govern. And one of the interesting things about this campaign, as I've written before, is that no matter who wins of the three candidates still standing, none of them have ever governed as an executive for a day. We don't know how they are as executives. It's a very different thing to decide, to convene your advisors and decide how you're going to vote on bill number, 37652, whatever it is, then to convene a bunch of advisors to decide whether to undertake a war or get out of a war or pass or sign a bill or whatever it is into law. So I think, I think this is one of the questions we need to ask about all the remaining candidates.
Well, let's go back and take a phone call. This is from Midge in Madison. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I was listening to you today, and I didn't hear any mention of the fact that yesterday, McCain had made the announcement that he would have all the troops out of Iraq by 1913. Now, from what you're saying, that's not likely his position, but he must just be doing it to undercut the peace movement. But do you think he actually would change his policy on that? And I was just surprised that nobody brought that up.
Thanks a lot, Midge. And I think you meant 2013. Otherwise, it would be a good trick. But thanks a lot for that call. What about that, Matt Bai?
1913 would be better. Midge, thank you for raising this because I think it's critically important. Obviously, occurred after my piece was completed. I'm gonna break a general rule I have about criticizing my colleagues, and I'm gonna say that I think my sense of this is that this is a case of journalism gone awry here, some shorthanding going on. I don't think this was reported quite fairly, to be honest with you. I've seen all the headlines, including in our own paper, about McCain sort of setting a timetable or a date. That's not what he did. If you actually look at what he said, he was using a rhetorical device, which is, look at, you know, 5 years from now, look at how great the world can be, yada, yada. I don't know that it was the best rhetorical device in the world. And one of the things he said, on top of other things, you know, gas prices are low and everybody's happy and, you know, thrilled and frolicking in the streets, was that by 2013, Americans are home and we've won the war in Iraq. Now, what he did not say decidedly was, he's not changed his position at all here. He did not say, by any means, you know, I'm going to get our troops out by 2013. That's a commitment. What he said was, I think we're going to win by then. I think if we pursue the right strategy, the strategy that I have, I think we're going to be able to proclaim victory and bring our soldiers home by 2013. That doesn't change the fact that he's willing to leave them there till 2020 if he has to. It doesn't. It's not a timetable for withdrawal. He doesn't have a set plan to do this. He's just, all he basically said was that he thinks we can win the war in Iraq within 5 years, and that's not a change at all in his position. So I think perhaps if you've been with McCain every day for the last 6 months, as some of these reporters have, and you've heard him routinely deride this idea of timetables, it may have sounded like a really big deal. But if you actually look at what he said, I don't think it's very significant at all.
Then why do you think the mention of a specific date at all?
Well, as I said, I think it was a rhetorical device. The whole speech was built around this notion that here's what the world can look like in 2013. I don't know why 2013. It seems kind of weird to me. I guess just because it's like 5 years from now and, you know, he would just be starting his second term or what have you. I don't know. But the speech was written by Mark Salter, who's McCain's sort of co-author and alter ego and a really fabulous speechwriter, in fact. So he must have had his reasoning. But I think this was a sort of speech device. It was, here's 2013, here's how great the world will look, and part of how great the world would look was that we're no longer at war. I mean, clearly they are trying to signal to people like Midge and others that even though McCain is pro-war and wants to stay, he doesn't see this as forever. He doesn't see it as a 100-year war. He thinks we're going to win in fairly short order, and that's the message they're trying to get across, right, is that he thinks this can be successful. But I would by no means interpret that, and McCain specifically said we should not interpret that as a commitment to bring the troops home. I think his main commitment, as he has said over and over again, is to leave the troops there as long as he has to.
I want to read an email we got from Chuck here. It says, this is regarding the success of the strategy in Iraq right now. He says, I just heard the statement that the surge has resulted in fewer casualties in Iraq, and I understand that not to be the case. From what Chuck understands, it is more the case of buying off Sunnis for $300 a month and a ceasefire, not the McCain-backed surge.
Well, this is a constant, you know, source of discussion that comes up. We can argue about this, and I wouldn't be arguing from a position of having been on the ground, which is how I like to know things. But, you know, I think it's fair to say there's a whole counterinsurgency strategy, and the surge is at the center of it, having those additional 20,000 troops to go out and secure and hold areas rather than secure them and then leave. And then there is this case of having armed and worked with and in some cases paid off militias. And there's a case of a more vigorous training going on with the Iraqi military. There are lots of factors contributing to what's happening on the ground. But I think you would have to grant him that the surge is the center of the new counterinsurgency strategy. It is a critical component, and that for whatever reason, that strategy has resulted in lower casualties. Now, I've seen that in the last couple of months, there's been a slight uptick. I think it went from like 50 casualties to 70 in a month or something like that. But and that's a lot of casualties. I'm not minimizing it at all. But it is nowhere near the levels that you were seeing prior to the institution of that new strategy. So we can sort of pick apart what parts of that strategy are effective and which aren't. But I think it would be pretty uncharitable not to grant that the surge is at least a major component of a strategy that has succeeded in bringing down casualties.
Well, Matt, we're in the last couple of minutes of the show here. I wonder if you could tell me before we go, what kind of sell do you think John McCain is going to have to make in the November election to get America behind his policy on Iraq?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think they know the answer to that, and they're struggling with it, and I think you saw part of that in that speech yesterday, which was trying to convince people, and frankly in the global warming speech earlier, and all the ways he's begun to try to distance himself from George W. Bush. You know, I think they're trying to soften that image. I think the feeling is that if they can convince people that John McCain is different than the president, is an independent thinker, has his own views on this, then they can get him a hearing. And that even if people disagree with him on Iraq, they might say, they might return to the way they saw John McCain in 1999 or 2000, which is, you know, a guy of deep conviction who says what he believes, and even if you disagree with him on one or two items, you know, you're going to give him a pass. I think that's complicated by a couple of factors. It's complicated by one factor that he had to do a lot of things to get the Republican nomination that have undermined that image. The one that comes to mind for me that I thought was probably most egregious was embracing the tax cuts that he had strongly voted against and spoken out against early in the Bush administration. That kind of thing, I think, undermined his status as a reformer and an independent voice.
Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
But I want to thank you so much for your time this hour. It's great.
Sure, thanks, Veronica.
Appreciate it. We talked there with Matt Bai, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of The McCain Doctrines, cover story for the May 18th issue of the Sunday Magazine. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program and Sarah Carroll for on-air production. I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.